From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today, a conversation with the first living recipient of the Medal of Honor since the Vietnam War, Staff Sergeant Sal Junta from Hiawatha. Junta graduated from Kennedy High School in Cedar Rapids in 2003. In about an hour, he'll receive the Medal of Honor from President Obama in a ceremony at the White House. This hour, we'll hear about the ambush of his patrol in a remote area of Afghanistan that led to the deaths of two in his unit and earned him the Medal of Honor. Then Rabbi Jay Holstein of the University of Iowa tells us what the heroes of antiquity and the present all have in common. A conversation with Medal of Honor winner Sal Junta after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we listen back to a conversation with Army Staff Sergeant Sal Junta of Hiawatha. Junta graduated from Kennedy High School in Cedar Rapids in 2003. In about an hour, Junta will become the first living recipient of the Medal of Honor since the Vietnam War. He will receive the nation's highest military honor from President Obama in a ceremony at the White House. There have only been 8 recipients of the Medal of Honor in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Junta, who serves with 173rd Airborne Brigade Combat Team, will receive the honor for his actions in a remote area of eastern Afghanistan in October of 2007. According to Army reports, when an insurgent force ambush split Junta's squad into 2 groups, he exposed himself to enemy fire to pull a comrade back to cover. Later, while engaging the enemy and attempting to link up with the rest of his squad, Junta noticed 2 insurgents carrying away a fellow soldier. He immediately engaged the enemy, killing one and wounding the other, and provided medical aid to his wounded comrade, while the rest of his squad caught up and provided security. I spoke with Sal Junta about a month ago, when he was in Italy, where he's stationed, and I began by asking him how that day started and what the mission was.
That day in Afghanistan started the same way pretty much any day starts. We were on a patrol, and it was part of a bigger mission. It was the 5th day of a mission called Rock Avalanche, and we set off before daybreak so we could walk under the cover of night to set up in our position overwatching a village there in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. So this is a regular day. This is you're on patrol, setting it to set up a position. This is nothing out of the ordinary.
No, I serve with the 173rd Airborne Infantry, and that is what our job is. Usually, whatever they ask of us, we'll do. But a patrol is usually what they ask of us. So,
And how does that patrol and setting up that position fit into the overall strategy of what's happening in that part of Afghanistan?
That day, our mission, because it was part of a bigger mission called Rock Avalanche, our piece of the mission was, as 1st Platoon, and there was about 18 of us that day, was going to be, it was about a 2-hour walk up to set up an overwatch over a village where another platoon is going to go into the village and engage the people of the village and let them know, hey, you know, we're here for you, we're not bad guys, we'll help you if you need help, we're trying to make your lives better. And our job was to basically pull a 360-degree circle on top of our ridge so we can protect ourselves and also watch the high ground so no one's set up on the people in the village and kind of take them by surprise. So we're just, you know, trying to keep everyone safe.
Mm-hmm. Had you any indications early on that there were unfriendly forces around?
There's always unfriendly forces around.
Yeah. Do you encounter these forces every week, every month,
well,
every day?
During the deployment that we're talking about was OEF-8, and we were in the Korangal Valley, so we were, you know, encountering forces, or I guess not necessarily encountering the forces, but at least getting shot at maybe 1 time a day, maybe 3 times a day, and then towards the winter, you know, it turns into more survival, so there's not a whole lot of kinetic activity going on, and we wouldn't get shot at for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. I understand at one point there was an ambush that split your squad into 2 groups. This is the squad of 18, if I'm understanding this correctly. How did that happen?
You know, they got lucky. The way the terrain dictates how we move, the mountains in the Korngal Valley are so steep and so difficult to navigate that you have to walk kind of certain trails, you know, otherwise you're just going to fall down the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we needed to walk back to go back to the Korngal outpost, which is where we were going that night, was we had to walk on this trail because the decline, or the almost like a cliff face we were taking, it was only, I don't know, walkable by this trail at that point. And we walked, and they had set up on us during the day. I mean, the way the terrain was and the way the mountain fell off, that they could be close to us, maybe 200 meters where we sat all day, and we'd never see them just because the way your vision works.
And they knew, or they had a good guess, that you would be coming that way.
I guess they had a pretty good guess, yeah, that day.
The ambush begins. How many of them were there?
There's all sorts of different reports and stuff about that. I mean, for me, looking back on and thinking about it, maybe 10, maybe 15, maybe 20. I don't really know. You know, I think if I really gave a number, I'd be too, you know, I'd probably exaggerate just because that day it seemed like a million, you know.
Mm-hmm. You're being given the Medal of Honor for a specific act during this combat. I understand that it's difficult for you to talk about that. You lost two men in your unit, one of them a good friend of yours, so I understand that it's hard to talk about this, but what can you tell us about the moment that earned you this Medal of Honor?
The moment, or the reason, or, I mean, why I'm talking to you today, I guess, is I did what I did because that's what we as infantry, that's what we as United States service members serving in faraway lands are asked to do. And we're asked to look out for each other and also serve the people, or serve the people's wishes back here. And that day, I didn't do anything in my eyes spectacular or amazing, because there was a lot of things that were going on and there was a lot of danger, and no one person was in more danger or less danger than the other ones. And I was able to do what I did because all the guys that I was with were doing everything they could, and that was just the next step. And the next step for me was to run forward. And when I ran forward, I kind of came into some stuff I didn't really expect. But
according to the military's reports, when this insurgent force ambush split your squad into two groups, you exposed yourself to enemy fire to pull a comrade back to cover, and that's what you're referring to. And when you rushed forward to rescue the member of your unit, you killed at least one of the insurgents, injured another one. I'm wondering, when you do that, what are the chief questions or decisions running through your mind? Or is that really the wrong question? Do you have time to make a conscious decision?
That day, we encountered an L-shaped ambush. And that is, if you're in the ambush, you're the one doing the ambush, it's a good thing. If you're caught in the ambush, it's a bad thing. But it's definitely something that we in the military train. We're carrying weapons, we're carrying guns, not just because they look cool in pictures, but because we're asked to use them. And so this is a very real scenario that anyone could find themselves in. And we were able to act as a unit, as a team, as a squad, as a platoon, and everyone knew what they had to do, and everyone was doing what they had to do. So as far as a thought process, there really wasn't one. We were just going through the motions that were already ingrained in us from probably basic training in the Army.
So it was a reflex, intuitive.
Absolutely.
And everyone in your unit acted as one.
We did. No one's concerned about themselves in that situation. Everyone's concerned about the person to their left and the person to their right. The same I am for them, they are for me, and that's what makes it all work out, because the individual isn't the one that matters, it's the group.
Many soldiers, I think, before they see combat, must wonder what they would do in such a situation as you found yourself in. Will I do what I was trained to do? Will I act effectively, honorably, quickly, make good decisions? Did you wonder about those sort of questions beforehand?
In that situation, no one likes to think about an ambush, especially such a close ambush. You know, at 20 meters, 25 meters, that really doesn't ever come out too well, even in the planning process. But I've been to Afghanistan prior for a year, and I saw combat. I got a Purple Heart. I've seen how I would react. Now, this was a little different situation. It was a little bit closer, and it was a little more intense than what I was used to. But, you know, you don't think. Like I said, it's just react.
Mm-hmm. Before you did, this was not your first moment of combat. Before you did have your first combat, though, were those questions that I mentioned running through your mind?
I definitely think so. I mean, joining the infantry, this is what our job is. We're not looking to, they're not going to give us computer skills. They're not going to show us a whole lot of how to do this paperwork. Our job is to be the men on the ground with the weapons, doing the things that men with weapons in a foreign country at war need to do. And, I mean, you can train it all you want. You can fire blanks out of the weapons, and you can pretend like, hey, fix this person, he's hurt. But until you actually get in that situation, you'll never know.
This took place in October of 2007, I understand, correct?
Yes.
How much of that experience do you feel you still have to work through?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, the whole, it's been almost 3 years, but talking about it doesn't necessarily help me handle it. And not thinking about it doesn't necessarily help me handle it. But as of lately, I've been kind of forced into having to relive it and talk about it and analyze it. And I don't know. I don't really have an answer to that question.
Hmm. You're forced because you're the first living recipient of the Medal of Honor since Vietnam, one of only eight awarded during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. What happened on that mountain that day took the lives of two of the men in your unit, including a close friend, I understand, of yours, Josh Brennan, wounded several others. I'm very sorry for that loss.
Me too. Everyone knew what they were getting into. That's what we were doing. We're doing our nation's bidding, and I'm proud to have my name said with their names.
Are there any other names besides Josh's you'd like to mention?
Absolutely. Josh Brennan was walking point. He was the first man, but behind him was Frank Eckrode. Behind him was Eric Gallardo. Behind him was myself. I had my SOL gunner, Caleb Casey. I had my 203 gunner, Garrett Clary. I mean, these are all men that are in the same position that I'm in. I know there was more people there. I don't know how that went for them, but I know as far as those names I named, they went through exactly what I went through.
Have you talked to the men who lived through this since then?
I have. I'm still, the unit I'm in, Battle Company 2nd of the 503rd, part of the 173rd Airborne Infantry, and some of them are still in the unit. Some of them are back in Afghanistan with the same company, mm-hmm. doing whatever is asked of them. And we talk about stuff, but we don't usually talk about this. We have a lot of good times we can remember that we don't have to go.
You don't talk about this. Why not go back to that if it's something not only you but others, any normal person would struggle with?
Just talking about it doesn't help me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not going to itch it if it doesn't scratch, so.
You know, the bond that we hear develops between soldiers in a unit during combat is something most of us will never experience in our lifetime. I wonder if you can help us understand that bond, what it's like to be with a group of soldiers and depend on each other in the way that you do to a civilian.
I think the best terms would be like a brother. I mean, everyone that I've met in the Army has come from so many places in the United States and Puerto Rico and Guam, and we're all here doing the same thing, and we're all put through some of these tests and some of these challenges together. But by the end of it, you know, the hottest fires help forge the hardest metals, and I think that bond we have as war creates our own brotherhood, and that's really the best way I can put it.
So all those labels, you're an Iowan, he's a Puerto Rican, he has a different skin color than yours, that disappears.
Yeah, that doesn't really mean anything.
You say you've been forced into the spotlight, forced to talk about this more than perhaps you'd like to. It must be very difficult to accept this high honor while at the same time having it be connected with the death of friends. How do you cope with that?
I'm still working with it every day, I think. I mean, it's not over, and it is very bittersweet. It is such a great thing, and it is such a huge honor, and it's an opportunity to let the American people know how hard its soldiers are fighting for them so they can live the lives they live every single day uninterrupted, when there's a large group of people that their lives are incredibly interrupted, and they're giving their blood, sweat, and tears so we can go to the mall and so we can hang out after school or whatever, you know, you do. And if this is what I can do is bring the attention to the people about all these other people, I could do this every day.
Have you spoken with their families? Have you spoken with Josh's family?
I have. I talk to Josh's dad fairly often, just kind of check in, see how he's doing. He checks in with me, see how I'm doing, see what's happening. He's a real good guy, and he's a very strong and proud father, as he should be. And it's good to talk to him.
The Pentagon is often reluctant to send Medal of Honor winners back into combat. You're in Italy now, I'm speaking to you, and you're on active duty. Is not going back into combat something you're okay with?
Honestly, I am looking at getting out of the Army here fairly soon. And, I mean, things could change and I could stay in, and whatever happens could happen, but I'll just figure I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. There's no sense getting too excited about what people are saying.
Mm-hmm. If you leave the Army, where would you go? Back to Iowa?
I think, honestly, now that I'm talking to you in Iowa, I am proud to be an Iowan, but I think Colorado. My wife and I are looking at Colorado. It kind of has, we've come accustomed to the mountains and we enjoy outdoors stuff and hiking and biking and camping and fishing, and keeps us in the Midwest, keeps us close to our family.
Your wife, I understand, is also an Iowan. She's from Dubuque. You're from Hiawatha. You graduated from Kennedy High School.
I did. Go Cougars.
You talked about the men in your unit, you and the men in your unit, don't dwell on that day, don't often talk about that, and you talk about some of the good times that you have. You'd rather talk about those times. So when you're on the aspects of being in a combat situation or on patrol, is a better way to say it, what will you miss most about that?
Wow, that was a difficult question. What will I miss most?
What will you remember most fondly being with those men?
The times we've shared. I mean, the things that you find funny in combat or in difficult situations are usually not funny to you when you're sitting on your couch at home, sipping a soda, eating popcorn, watching a movie.
For example, you have anything that comes to mind?
Nothing for the radio, I don't think, because it takes, maybe for some other book or something like that, but I don't want to go too far. Just it's strange the things you find funny.
Mm-hmm. The Medal of Honor is awarded to those who went above and beyond the call of duty. Do you feel like what you performed that day was above and beyond the call of duty?
I think
certainly I did. Sounds like it, according to this report.
I think I did what everyone else was doing. I think because of the circumstances and because of the piece that I did is what people are calling above and beyond, but I don't think there's anyone in Afghanistan or Iraq right now that you can't say is going above and beyond the call of duty. I mean, they're leaving their families, they're leaving their wives, their children, their mothers, their fathers, their grandparents. They're leaving life in a fairly secure country behind to go to a third world country and fight. So that seems pretty much to me above and beyond.
Army Staff Sergeant Sal Giunta, you are now a national hero. You have been awarded the Medal of Honor. It gives you a platform that only a very select group of people have. How do you plan to use this honor?
I hope that with this honor and with this platform that it is providing, that I can really put the word out, because I think that the American soldier, the American service member, the Navy, the Marines, the Coast Guard, the Air Force, the National Guard, the Reserve, all of them are doing such an incredible job and have been doing such an incredible job for quite a while now. And I just want to make sure that the people understand that, because they're not necessarily just doing it for themselves, they're doing it for every American citizen.
How many interviews have you done on this topic?
I think I've done, I don't know, between the newspapers and the radios and the television interviews, probably 30 or 40 now.
What do you think of all this media attention? And just as soon it be all over?
I think as long as it stays positive and it stays about everyone, I can accept it and I can do it. But, you know, I'm a pretty calm, relaxed guy from Iowa, and all this media attention is, it's a lot. It's big. I mean, and it kind of came really overnight.
You mentioned earlier how in your squad, you know, whether you're from Iowa or Illinois or Puerto Rico, the difference is kind of where you're from, your skin color, your ethnic background kind of disappear when you're in a squad like that. Of course, in our headlines, too, the politics of gays in the military has been part of the discussion. Do you think that having gays serve openly in the military would affect the combat readiness of a unit like you serve in?
Gays in the military. That's a big question, and I got to tell you, we're in the military, and we do what they say. So if they say yes, then that's how it is. If they say no, then that's how it is, and we'll just act accordingly.
So I'm hearing that you're saying it would not impair the combat readiness of a squad like yours.
If they say it won't, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. The future is untold, so I can't really speak on that.
We hear so many reports, of course, how the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are going, and, of course, Afghanistan, a big question mark. When we consume these reports here stateside, what do you think? Winnable?
I don't know if we're trying to win it. I think we're over there helping, and we're doing everything we can, and we're trying to make life better for everyone on this planet.
In just a few minutes, in the last part of my conversation with Army Staff Sergeant Sal Giunta of Hiawatha, Giunta will tell us about a phone call from President Obama that informed him that he would receive the nation's highest military honor. Today, Giunta becomes the first living recipient of the Medal of Honor since the Vietnam War. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now back to the tail end of my conversation with Army Staff Sergeant Sal Giunta of Hiawatha. In about a half hour at the White House, President Obama will award Giunta the Medal of Honor. He will be the first living recipient of the nation's highest military honor since the Vietnam War. The Medal of Honor is awarded for acts of gallantry at the risk of one's life that go above and beyond the call of duty. On September 9th, President Obama called Giunta in Italy, where he was stationed and where we also reached him. I asked Giunta to tell us about the phone call from the president telling him that he would receive the military's highest honor.
I kind of knew it was coming. You know, you don't really believe it until it's actually happening. At least I didn't. I got a call from a gentleman the day before, and he told me, you know, be by the phone at this time, and there'll be someone there to talk to you, and don't tell anyone that I said this. I gave him, you know, Roger, okay, can do. And so I didn't tell anyone, but I did tell my wife. I had to tell my wife.
You had an inkling that it was some kind of honor.
I didn't necessarily have an inkling, but no one has ever told me to sit by a phone. I mean, I have a cell phone, so we could do it that way, but giving me an exact time to be by the phone to make sure no one else picks it up was kind of, it was probably something big, and if it was something big, I wanted my wife there with me anyway.
She was with you when he called?
She was. She was right there by my side.
What did the president say?
It was a big moment when he first started talking, and, you know, that's the commander-in-chief. That, for the military, that's the big boss. There's no bigger boss that we have than the President of the United States. And hearing him talk to me and not just address, you know, the nation, not just addressing the video cameras, but to say my name and talk to me personally was... it was huge. I mean, it was an honor. It was a privilege. It was exciting. I was nervous. Everything rolled into one.
Do you remember any specific words that he said that have stuck with you?
I've been asked this question a couple times, and I was my ears started kind of clouding up, and my heart was pounding. I was squeezing my wife's hand, and I remember him saying that, you know, he's had the privilege to approve the Medal of Honor for actions in the Korangal Valley, Afghanistan, October 25th, 2007. And he said more. I really wish I could remember more, but it was pretty nervous. I was nervous when he was talking. So
the military doesn't record these conversations.
I don't think so. I'm curious if they do. I mean,
would be. Yeah, I can imagine anybody in that situation would sort of have a blank as he with the rush of excitement. Did you remember what you said to the president?
I think I just acknowledge. Roger, Mr. President. Thanks, Mr. President. I think that's it. There was actually a lot of other guys in the office, just kind of floating in and out. It was only 5 o'clock in the evening, so people were getting ready to head home. And the second I said Mr. President the first time, people started standing up and staring at me. And if I didn't have enough going on the phone and the wife and the president, and those eyes didn't help anything.
So I imagine some silence when you were talking after the people in the room heard Mr. President. Did everything get quiet?
I don't remember if they were talking or not. I mean, I stopped. Once I saw him, you know, stand up and kind of look at me, I just put my head down. I wasn't going to help matters.
And the conversation ended, and what happened in the room after that?
The conversation ended, and when I looked up, there was a lot more people in the room than when I put my head down. And there was a couple more phone calls that came in after the president was done talking, and I spoke with them. And after that, you know, I looked at my wife. I gave her a hug and a kiss and a deep breath.
Tears,
probably the first breath I took in 3 minutes or so.
Anybody in the room have tears in their eyes?
No one had tears, but I was squeezing my wife's hand pretty hard, I'm sure, and I think she was squeezing mine pretty hard as well.
Army Staff Sergeant Sal Giunta, it is my pleasure and my honor to have spoken with you and for you to have granted us this interview. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Joining me now, Rabbi Jay Holstein, the J.J. Mallon Teaching Chair of Judaic Studies in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Iowa. In classes, Professor Holstein teaches about the degree to which heroic interests have been with us since antiquity, since the dawn of recorded history. And he has been listening to that interview that we had with Sal Giunta, the Medal of Honor recipient. Rabbi Holstein, what jumps out at you when you hear this conversation with Army Staff Sergeant Sal Giunta?
First, the obvious. It's hard even to talk. An extraordinary young man, doing extraordinary things for the country. It's just an honor to be in any way, shape, or form, me, a professor, not under fire in the classroom, a professor to be identified with such a young man. What I didn't think was going to happen happened in the course of the interview. Images of my maternal grandfather leapt into my mind. My maternal grandfather, at the age of 17 in Latvia, decided to join the army. During the course of his physical, they saw he was circumcised and therefore Jewish and would not permit him to go into the army. And he on the spot decided that a country who would not let him enlist was no country for him. He made his way to a port city with the intent of boarding a ship to what was then called Palestine to take part in the building of a modern Jewish nation state. He got on the wrong ship, wound up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, without the language, without friends, without resources, without anything. Suffice it to say that in the decades that followed, this became his promised land. He loved this country. He, when he died, he owned the third largest trucking company in Philadelphia, and that was the least of it. He took to the culture. He took to Melville. He took to Hemingway. He took to movies. And he is always with me to a greater or lesser extent in the classroom. And if he could have seen his grandson be identified with a young man such as this, an American, I believe it would have brought joy to his heart.
You have studied, researched, and taught about heroes in your many courses. Over decades, you've been teaching. What kinds of heroes do you focus on in your teaching? What do they have to do with Sal Giunta of Hiawatha?
It's a good question. It's a profound question, and I am not a profound thinker. I try to dwell on simple things. It seems to me heroism is generated by that uncertain territory that is always moving between selfishness on the one hand and love on the other, and the willingness sometimes to sacrifice oneself for love of others, for love of ideas, and in this case, and dramatically, for love of country.
So take us back hundreds, maybe thousands of years to one of your favorite heroes.
I'll take you back 3,500 years before the birth of Jesus. An anonymous genius wrote a narrative which has come to be called, we don't know what the title really was, The Epic of Gilgamesh. It involves the adventures and misadventures of a man who is larger than life. When first we meet him, he is king of the most powerful city on earth, and he is abusing his power. His selfish appetites are bringing his country to its knees. He seeks to gratify these appetites at any cost, and no one can teach him otherwise. A series of incidents generated by the ironic activities of the gods, involve him in a friendship which chastens him. He begins to understand that everything he had believed may no longer be true now that he is in love. He's in love with another human being. What he had believed was that the meaning of life was to operate in such a way that people would sing songs about you after you left. What he comes to believe is that it's not the singing of the song. That's not why you're doing these things. You're doing out of love for another. So when we first meet him, he's selfish. When we last meet him, he has been brought to his knees by life, as many of us are, but he is certain that he understands what his duty now is as king, to serve his nation and not his own selfish activities. And getting there involves heroic activities which range from confronting death without blinking, the way Sergeant, is it Sergeant? The way Sergeant
Staff Sergeant Sal Giunta.
The way he clearly did, but also the kind of heroic activity that many of us, as a matter of course, are involved in, loyalty to friends and family, decency, in the most mundane areas which make life livable and possible.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wanted to see if we could take heroism out of the realm of combat and have you talk about what we might say are everyday heroes. So we don't have to have a bayonet, an M1, an
That's
M16
right.
in our hands, do we?
That's right. You know, it's hard to know how you end up where you end up. I have not served in the military. My father was in Korea. My brother was in Vietnam. And my son served in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I tried to get in the Army, but I have a bad heart murmur. So I was never able to make it. But I am not calling myself a hero. You got to understand this, please. Everybody, I know what it is that I do. It's very mundane. But to do it honestly, to do it well, to be worthy of love, giving and receiving love, to be worthy of a friendship, it's what makes the world go around.
In studying heroism over decades, centuries, and thousands of years, as you have, do you notice that how the nature of heroism has changed at all, or are we rock solid consistent?
I think it's rock solid consistent in terms of the willingness to sacrifice parts of oneself for the good of others. And sometimes this willingness entails no more than, here, it's my last piece of good food. You take it. And sometimes it involves exposing yourself to risk. And sometimes it involves doing what you don't want to do. And sometimes, in the most dramatic and public way, it involves our military doing what it is that they do to make this country safe. But the fundamentals of it, it seems to me, it have always been the same.
If you've just joined us, my guest in this second half hour of The Exchange is Rabbi Jay Holstein. He's the J.J. Mallon Teaching Chair of Judaic Studies in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Iowa. The reason we're having him on for this half hour, if you heard our first half hour, you had a conversation with Army Staff Sergeant Sal Junta of Hiawatha, the first living recipient of the Medal of Honor. And Rabbi Jay Holstein, in his classes over many decades, has been teaching about the degree to which heroic interests have been with us for many thousands of years. And I wonder, when we see that Staff Sergeant Sal Junta of Hiawatha is a hero, many others in the world would see Osama bin Laden as a hero, Hitler as a hero for many in the Axis powers during the Second World War. So is a hero only in the eye of the beholder?
Yes. The notion that a value or beauty, whatever, is only in the eyes of the beholder assumes a higher category, even there to distinguish between good and bad. I believe, let's take Hitler. I teach a course on the Bible and the Holocaust and spend a lot of time on Hitler. When I first started teaching the course, I had assumed that he was kind of a joke, you know, who just fell into things, and he was like Charlie Chaplin. I kept picturing Charlie Chaplin. But it turns out Hitler had a first-rate mind. It turns out Hitler was courageous when courage was needed. It turns out that Hitler was popular in Germany and did many great things. It turns out that when it's time to die, he gave the speech of his life and put a gun to his head. The woman he loved put a gun to her head. In many ways, all the lineaments of heroism attach themselves and define Hitler. But the vision for which you're sacrificing things means everything. His vision arrogated to some more humanity than others. His vision indicated that one such as myself was subhuman and not human at all. So for all of his strength, for all of his character, for all of his mental capacities, there is all the difference in the world between Nazism, and we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all human beings are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, whether somewhere where the gods reside and talk about such things, there are better and worse arguments for Nazism and the American vision, I do not know. I just know what the American vision has meant for my people, for my children, for my ancestors. I know that in the depths of my being, but I acknowledge that our enemies are often heroic. It makes them more dangerous.
When we think about contemporary heroes, Sal Junta, or also when we talk about Hollywood portrayals of heroic acts, modern-day heroes, I have to think back
to the blockbuster Saving Private Ryan from a few years ago. Private Ryan ties back into Gilgamesh, ties into Sal Giunta as well.
That's right. That's right. A normal man placed in extraordinary circumstances.
But this is a fiction. This is a fictional account.
Asked to do exceptional things. Spielberg begins and ends in a cemetery with rows and rows of crosses interspersed with more than a few Jewish stars of David. And one understands that that at this moment of truth, when our democracy hung by a thread, it didn't matter. It didn't matter whether you were Jewish or Christian or pagan. The only thing that mattered was whether you were willing to pay the ultimate price. It took me a while for me to understand it, but Spielberg starts and ends his film not in the cemeteries, but in the cemetery, but with the picture, a long shot of an American flag waving in the wind.
I remember that.
Translucent in the sun. And you look at it and you're thinking, what does this genius of a director want us to see? And I don't know for a fact. If I ever meet him, it'll be the first question I ask him. It seems to me that there are no crosses and there are no Jewish stars on the American flag. This is the country of anyone who subscribes to the vision that all human beings are created equal. Religion is a private affair. And in the course of that movie, when the Hanks character says, "Earn this," to the Damon character, and the Damon character kneels before the grave, I can't get words out. It is the power of the heroic moment, heroic deeds performed by people whom, had the army not called, never would have known the heights to which they could have ascended. Never would have known.
Your son, Joshua Holstein, is a combat veteran of both Iraq and Afghanistan. He served in the 505th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 82nd Airborne on these tours in Afghanistan, in Iraq. I'm just thinking, it must be something to teach all these years, all these decades, about heroism going back through decades and then send your own son off to war in a foreign land.
It's a sobering experience. It's one thing to watch a great movie. It's one thing to weep in the context of that movie. And it's another thing to get a call in the middle of the night when your son is deployed, not knowing what this call means. And everything Sergeant Giunta said about the Army, everything about why these men and women do what it is they do, because the one by your side depends on it, and because that's what they're trained to do, was confirmed in the experiences of my son. My son went in the Army before 9/11. Everything turned on a dime. I was teaching a class called Old Testament Survey when my cell phone went off, and it was Joshua from Fort Bragg. I didn't even know that the planes had hit the building. And Joshua said, the base has been shut down. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Word is, we're wheels up to an uncertain place. Goodbye. I love you. Now, it's sobering. And all these families in Iowa and everywhere else are going through this right now. When I came to this campus, the campus was shut down because of protests over the Vietnam War. It was a bad time. But now, in a way, it's even a worse time because my students are blissfully unaware of what people their age are doing over there. In a theoretical way, they understand it, but they, because there's no draft, they don't understand it in their guts. I harp on it all the time, but they don't, and I didn't understand it. You understand what I'm saying, Ben?
Yeah.
I didn't understand it.
It's a disconnect in our society.
It is. It's very, very sad. God bless people like Sergeant Giunta.
I want to thank you very much, Rabbi Jay Holstein. It's been a pleasure having you share your thoughts with us.
It's always good to talk to a former student.
Rabbi Jay Holstein is the J.J. Mallon Teaching Chair of Judaic Studies in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Iowa. The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. And we do always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime. TheExchange@iowapublicradio.org is our email. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.